Morning, everybody. I'm Don Landis. I'm an alcoholic. Incredibly excited to be here and get to talk about resentment this morning, a subject near and dear to my heart. I want to thank Emily for the fine introduction and, more importantly, for picking us up in the airport, being a tremendous host, and being so kind to my wife. You know, sometimes my wife and I travel and she can get ignored and they're busy talking to me, and you did the opposite move. You ignored me and talked to my wife, and strong move, huge, and your stock is rising, Emily. And I want to thank all the other speakers that have come before me and that are going to speak after me. You've 12-stepped me this weekend. I'm fired up. I got to tell you, I'm so happy to be at State Line. This is an amazing event. You know, it's kind of, I was talking to Bob, and I said, you know, it's weird. It's kind of like the Comic-Con of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. It's like, because we're, you know, the true believers are here, you know what I mean? We're kind of the geeks and the nerds of AA, and, you know, you'll find people in the corner having a deep conversation about the concepts, or you'll have, I mean, in the corner talking about the deep spiritual significance of the seventh tradition, oh, and, you know, and in our home groups, you know, we got to hold it back a little bit, you know what I mean? You got to wheel it back in. You don't want to scare off the new guy. You want to come screaming across the room at some newcomer going, it's going to be great, you're going to love it, you know, and, so you got to kind of hold that in check. And here you can let your freak flag fly, you know what I mean? Just, and I love that energy that's in the room that, you know, people in this room are in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And that means a lot to me because I love AA, man, because you saved my life. You know, I'm a real alcoholic. I'm not a heavy drinker. I'm not a social drinker. I'm not a teetotaler. I'm not one of those. I'm a real alcoholic. I'm the guy that came here hopeless, helpless, and hapless. I'm not going to make it. I'm going to die a horrible alcoholic death. Anyone that knew me, my family, my friends, past employers, girlfriends, they were waiting for the call. They knew I was going to die. And yet, I stand in front of you with a sobriety date of September 16th, 1991, over 27 years, continuous sobriety, living the best life I've ever known, surrounded by the best people I've ever known, and I have all of you to thank for it. The members of Alcoholics Anonymous, you should feel good about yourself. You should stand up straight. You should honor your membership and know, like Billy N says, man, we're in the saving lives business. We're Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm here to tell you, you saved my life. And that means the world to me. I'll be forever grateful because I didn't see it coming. You see, I brought nothing to the party. I got nothing left. And that's the wonderful news that Alcoholics Anonymous carries to the sufferer. You don't have to be bigger, stronger, faster, smarter than the next guy to make it around here. The rubber seems to make, you know, meet the road on who's willing to take the actions dictated in the first 164 pages of that big book. And you don't, Alcoholics Anonymous does not work because of the alcoholic. It works in spite of him. And that's really good news for a guy like me, because you're going to have to overcome a lot of stuff that I bring to the game that's trying to kill me. Old ideas, misconceptions, and some of the things I'm going to talk about this morning, and in particularly my resentments. You know, you're going to have to overcome those things if I'm going to survive a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I want to thank my beautiful wife, Eileen, for, God, sharing the sober home that we have, for traveling with me, being my biggest fan, pulling my covers on a regular basis. And I love you like good poetry, man. I'm just grateful we get to do this thing together. And she's a real alcoholic, too, and she is not a social drinker, I'll tell you that. You know, all I know about how... I'll tell you my favorite story about my wife and social drinking. When we got engaged, and Eileen met my sister for the first time, my older sister, Pat, man, Pat fell in love with Eileen. She pulled me aside immediately and said, you screw this up, I'll kill you. And they threw a big engagement party for us when we got engaged, and there was some social drinking going on at the engagement, what I call white wine drinking, you know what I mean? Not drinking, drinking, not go to jail, crash the car drinking, you know, just social drinking. And we're in the kitchen talking to my sister, and she's got a glass of white wine. And at some point, she recognized some people in another part of the house and wanted to go say hi. And she put her white wine down and said, I'll be right back. I'm going to go talk to these folks. And off she went. Eileen happened to notice that. And she looked at Pat's white wine. And she looked at Pat getting further away. And she looked at Pat's white wine. And she turned to me a little concerned and said, Pat left her wine. And I said, yeah, she did. She goes, well, should I go tell her? And I said, baby, at this particular moment, she's not suffering from separation anxiety. But you see, we're real alcoholics, man. We're the ones that we think the bad idea is the good idea. You know what I mean? Like right before we go to the ER, we say, watch this. You know, we just... And if there's anybody new in the room, to, you know, I don't know who's in the room. Is there anybody here in their first 6 months of sobriety? Raise your hand so I know where you are. If you're in here, awesome. Awesome. I want to let you know you're cordially welcome here. I hope you find a home in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're surrounded by a bunch of true believers, people that might be putting you off a little bit. We're a little much, man, when you first get here. I understand. Hands and teeth, we're so damn glad to see you. We're expecting a miracle. It can be a little off-putting, but you know why we're so excited is we know something you can't possibly know yet. What a wonderful life awaits you in Alcoholics Anonymous. The best years of your existence lay ahead. And we know that because it's happened to us. And we didn't believe it any more than probably you do. But I'll tell you what, keep the faith. Keep walking. Stay close. Stay on the path. You know, shoulder to shoulder. You don't have to do this thing alone. You don't have to hurt no more. And we know the way out. We understand that you took a long, long, dangerous walk in some dark, dark, dangerous woods. And we know you're going to have to walk out. But here's the point. You walked in alone, right? But you're walking out with us. We're Alcoholics Anonymous, and we know the way. So hold on tight, because we don't want to lose anybody. And so I'm so excited for our new friends that are here to get to partake in a weekend like this. You know, these weekends are important to me because I get recharged. You know what I mean? It's like a pit stop in that race, you know, that race of life. You know, we got those jobs, those mortgages to pay, and those kids to raise, and bills to pay, and file your taxes, and do all this, and get to your meetings, and get to your home group, and work with the people you sponsor, and on, you can get in that merry-go-round. And just to be able to take a step back, whew, take a little pit stop, come to a place like State Line, fill up the tank, change the tires, go, yeah, I'm ready, man. You know, we get home to our respective home groups. Don't let us off the leash, right? And they won't have to ask where we've been this weekend. Oh, God, you're at State Line again, weren't you? Man, we all heard Debbie give that amazing presentation on concepts. We're going to roll back in our home groups telling them the connection between group sex and the concepts. Proudly and defiantly. Concepts are sexy. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous September 16th, 1991, and all the good is gone. And I don't see any way out. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to get sober. I already know a guy like me doesn't get sober. I've been doing everything within my power, my human power, what I bring to the game naturally. My instincts, my emotion, my intellect, my self-will, and I've applied it to my alcoholism, and it's getting worse, not better, and I'm more dead than alive when I get here, and I know it's not going to work for me. And a couple of things happened immediately in Alcoholics Anonymous that changed and saved my life. The first thing that happened is I got a sponsor. Happened my second night in recovery. I don't even know what a sponsor is at this point. But I get this guy who, without my permission, I might add, started telling me what I'd be doing in Alcoholics Anonymous, and immediately he got me involved in AA and all three sides of the triangle. And it doesn't take long to fall in love with a thing like Alcoholics Anonymous if you're in the right place with the right people. Because what my sponsor gave me was the most valuable thing that he can give a newcomer. He gave me his time. It wasn't his deep understanding of the idiosyncrasies of step 6 and 7. It was his time. It was his concern. It was his care. It was his spiritual enthusiasm. It wasn't what he talked about. It was how he said it. He was a man with a real answer, and he was giving it away, and he was so excited that I was here in Alcoholics Anonymous, that everything about him shouted out to me that he had a solution, and I had one too, simply because I had met him and found a magic place called Alcoholics Anonymous. Isn't that something? Low point of my existence, yet when I was with this guy in rooms filled with people like you, I felt hopeful. Hopelessly in debt, hadn't worked in a year, warrants for my arrest in 2 counties, no watch, no wallet, no keys, no permanent address, no car, no nothing, no girlfriend, no hope, just a loser. And little did I know that I was perfect for Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that the worse you are, the better they like you. I didn't know that. I'm like, oh, he's pathetic. I love him, you know. I got something, man, that's valuable, right? I got something, I got buckets of something that's the most important thing a newcomer can bring to Alcoholics Anonymous, the most important commodity that a newcomer can have. And I didn't even know I had it, right? And I wouldn't have recognized its value at the time. And you know why? Because it doesn't make you feel good. And at that point in my life, if it doesn't make you feel good, it's valueless, right? My whole life has been an endless pursuit to make myself happy. How would I know this commodity I possess in buckets is going to be the very thing that saves my life? And what is that commodity? We call it desperation. And I didn't know that desperation actually turns out to be the propellant that takes somebody through the steps. I didn't know that. But if you work with new people, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But the thing about this desperation, this propellant that pushes us through the work here in Alcoholics Anonymous, like any propellant you can think of, you don't have an inexhaustible supply. And everybody's a little different. How much has that new guy or new girl got? 30 days? 60 days? 90 days? Because we all know the point when we work with people when they run out of their propellant. Because it seems like one night they're like, yeah, I did that. What do I do next? Then you ask them to show up early and help you set up, and they go, why is it always me? Isn't there somebody else you can ask that you sponsor? You know, I've got a life too, out of propellant. And I know, man, because I ran out of my propellant too. You know, I got into AA, got into steps right away, fired through the first three steps. You know what I mean? Boom, boom, boom. And I had what the book warns about, promises, but then warns about. You know, I had an incredible spiritual reaction to taking the third step. I mean, it was uplifting. It was unbelievable. I felt the nearness of God. I knew for the first time that it was real. And it was just remarkable. My sponsor immediately lined me out on the fourth step and said, we got to keep walking. We got to keep. And I, you know, and I'd read the book 10 times by this time. I'm 3 months sober. You know, I know what the book says. And the first thing the book leaves, there's a transition between the third step and the fourth step. And it says, next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. Though our decision, third step, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless followed at once by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us, right? So that's the timeline. When do you do your fourth step after you've done your third step? There's two words here. Next, at once. Anybody confused? I was, seemingly. Although I knew what that meant, this is what I thought. Man, I'm going to 14 meetings a week. I got commitments at every meeting. I got a sponsor. I've been in AA and sober for a really, really long time, like 92 days, you know? And hey, man, I don't make fun of that. When you've been drunk for a decade, when you're a bar drinker by desire and a couch drinker by ability, and you've been hanging out drinking Safeway whiskey on a dirty couch, and suddenly you're in AA with that beehive of activity, and you're going to meetings every night, and isn't this great, and let's go out to coffee. Oh, my God. It's exhausting. You know how it is. You're in that second meeting that night. You just want to go to sleep, and your sponsor's hitting you in the back of the head to keep you awake. You just want to go home. And then somebody goes, hey, we're going out to coffee. You want to go? Coffee? Kaya, coffee sounds good. I've only had 15 cups tonight. Why don't we have another cup of coffee? Yeah. Double espresso would hit the spot right now, right now, right now, right now. And off we go. Can't sleep at night. Talk to my sponsor. He goes, I think you're drinking too much coffee. That's not it. That's not it. It's shame and remorse. Trust me. Really. I feel terrible. But I'm doing all this activity, not action, but activity in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm involved in the fellowship, not the program. And I stall out between steps 3 and 4. I miss the warning. Little permanent effect unless followed at once by a strenuous effort to rid ourselves of the things that have been blocking us. I understand what that means. I'm just going to take a little break. Not long, maybe a day or two, and then I'll start writing. I'll start writing that resentment list that my sponsor lined me out on. Well, you know what happens. A couple of days turns into a week, turns into 10 days, turns into 2 weeks. And now I'm stalled out in the steps. And it's so funny. Up until that point, man, I'm in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor, God, I'm thinking about nominating him for sainthood. I love this guy. And suddenly, my sponsor and all of you, I started noticing some things about you. For one, I noticed that when I was cleaning up the clubhouse at the end of the night, a lot of the old-timers were sitting around telling off-color stories, drinking coffee, watching this newcomer work. Well, that doesn't seem fair. He just shared in the meeting about service is magic, and it's the key. Why don't you grab a broom there, Sparky? I'm hearing you talk about rigorous honesty. Then I hear about that guy over there just got served papers by the IRS. Ooh, a little hypocrisy's afoot, isn't it? And I start to notice the imperfection of the other AA members. And my sponsor, he's not that bright. I mean, let's be honest. Like what? The guy's smart because he hasn't, like, drank in a while. That makes him know stuff. And I'm getting angry and I'm getting weird, you know what I mean? And I can't sleep at night and I'm talking to my sponsor about it and I'm telling him how I don't think AA's working for me anymore and I'm starting to get angry all the time and he's starting to get between me and people because I'm threatening people in Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm at a discussion meeting and we're sharing back and forth and I mispronounce the word altruistic. It happens when you're new. And And then two guys after me, you know, he gives this little share, and at the end of his share, and he goes, oh, and by the way, Don, it's pronounced altruistic. And then I don't even remember leaving my feet. I'm just in the air across the table, and I'm taking him out of his chair, and I'm not, and I got my thumbs locked. I'm killing him, you know? And I'm, how's this for altruistic, you son of a, you know? I'm tense and volatile, they'd say. And my sponsor pulls me off and he drags me outside and he goes, hey, why don't you write that inventory? Because what you got going on, kid, is you're suffering from untreated alcoholism. And I say, that's not it. That's not it. He goes, have you ever written an inventory? Well, no. How do you know that's not it? I'm just smart that way. I just know. And I tell him about my big problems. Hopelessly in debt, got warrants for my arrest, you know. Now you got me a job. I'm back to work. I'm three months sober, right? I got a sponsor who won't let me go back in aerospace where I had worked for over a decade. No, no, no. You'll make the big money. Your ego won't be smashed. And then you'll drink and you'll die and it won't matter. No, Don, for you, we need something humbling. So he gets me a job as a laborer on a framing crew. I've never worked with my hands before. I don't know how that works. I got a nickname on the job site, the bleeder, you know what I mean? I'm going to two meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous a night. I'm not sleeping at night. I go to work and bleed for 8 to 10 hours, and I go and I rinse, wash, repeat. I'm not digging it. And I'm getting crazy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor's pointing out to me, he goes, when I talk to you, it's interesting. You're never in the moment. Every time I talk to you, you're in the past and remorse, you're in the future and worry. But never are you in the moment, in the here and now. Let me ask you something, Don. Right now, you and me, standing in the clubhouse, you okay? I said, yeah, man, I'm fine right now with you, but listen, tomorrow, he goes, whoop, just left the moment, the moment, the moment. What's he talking about? I got a head like a beehive, you know what I mean? I don't have any, explain to me why it was so essential for an alcoholic to spend as much of his time in the moment as possible. He said, our only shot at existence is a conscious contact with a higher power. And he goes, and the only place you can meet God is in the moment. You can't meet him yesterday and you can't meet him tomorrow. Just here and now, this second, right now, that's where you can meet God. And if you're never here, you're never going to have that connection. And without that, we're as good as dead. And I know that's not it. I know it's the terrible job I have. I know it's the fact I burned my life to the ground. I know it's the fact that AA is full of hypocrites. I know it's the fact that my sponsor means well, but he just doesn't understand how damaged I am. You know, my feelings, my needs. Why can't we ever talk about my boundaries? You know, come on. I mean, I go to him with my big problems, and he just laughs. He thinks it's hilarious. He thinks it's the funniest thing in the world. God. It's not funny, man. I have no sense of humor about myself. But he thinks it's all fun and games. I owe the IRS $80,000, right? I feel terrible about that. I want to tell my sponsor how bad I feel, how it's never going to be okay. He's not even interested. He doesn't even seem like it's important. Oh, you know, it's a lot of money, but people have come with more. You'll be fine. Don't worry about it, you know. He won't even give me any FaceTime with it. But you know what he did? You know what he did? He took that bit of information and immediately put it into service in Alcoholics Anonymous. For the next 5 years, any newcomer that had the audacity of complaining about his little weenie $1,200 IRS debt, my sponsor would listen to him and go, hold that thought, Jimmy. Hey, Don, you got a minute? And I'd walk over and he'd go, Don, tell Jimmy how much you owe the IRS. And I'd go, I owe the IRS $80,000. And Jimmy'd go, Jesus! And I'd say, just want to be a service. And I'd walk away. Alcoholics Anonymous, we care. No, you don't. So I've got this cruel sponsor and this maniacal AA schedule and this horrible job, and I'm crazy and I'm suffering from untreated alcoholism, and I don't know it. Most destructive aspect of our disease is the sufferer is the last one to know. Years ago, I'm at USC Medical in the alcoholic ward. And we would show up in Southern California at this hospital and institution panel. And we'd go into the ward and we would talk to the nurse and we'd say, can we talk to any of the alcoholics? And they'd say, well, you know, walk bed to bed and ask their permission. And most of them were so out of it, right, that they wouldn't even know you were there. And every now and then you'd get lucky and somebody would let you talk to them about AA. I remember we went up to this one bed, and the guy's laying there, and his liver is laying on the bed next to him. And when I say that, I'm not exaggerating. I'd already heard that expression. I'd never seen it. And it's distended to the point that it's laying next to him through his skin on the bed. And I remember being mortified, like, holy cow. And the panel leader said, hi, we're members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're here. And the guy explodes. Get away from me with that AA crap. I'm not an alcoholic. And I looked at his liver, and I said, man, this dude's doing a great impersonation if he's not. We're the last ones to know we got this thing. Right under the boneyard, as we take our last breath, you don't understand. I know what it looks like, but I'm not an alcoholic. And I'm suffering from that at 3.5, 4 months sober, stalled on the steps. And I get up one morning at my sister's house where I'm getting sober, and I've got to go down to this job that I'm going to bleed at all day, and it's a Friday morning, and I'm exhausted. You know what I mean? Fridays were always the worst. And I've been begging my sponsor, begging him for a night off. Man, can you give me a night off of AA? I'm grateful to be here, but I just can't take it anymore. And he'd say, man, you know what? He got out the sponsor handbook, and he looked it up, and it said, look, it says right there, nobody ever died from lack of sleep, you know? And I remember the first time he said that to me, I made a commitment that I was going to die from lack of sleep and be a martyr for all the newcomers that came after me. I had a beautiful vision of my sponsor and his sponsor standing at my graveside, turning to each other and go, damn, we killed one of them, you know? And I got up on this Friday, and I've been sober forever, like 4 months, which is enough time to decide whether something works for you or not. And I knew AA didn't work. And I made a decision to quit Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to go down to the clubhouse. If I got to sign something, I'll sign something. I'm done. Because I can't take it. Because, you see, I'm a real alcoholic, and I'm suffering from untreated alcoholism, and the noise in my head is too loud, and I can't take it. The pressure's increased on a daily basis, and I can't take it anymore. And I know what makes the big hurt go away, and I've got to get out of AA, and I've got to get away from you, and I know it's going to cost me everything. It's going to cost me where I live. It's going to cost me my family that I've just gotten back. It's going to cost me my membership in Alcoholics Anonymous, and more than likely, it's going to cost me my life, and that's a small price to pay if I can go back and make that magic happen again. One more vain attempt to prove I can drink like other people, because I can't take the madness. You see, I have an adverse reaction to sobriety. My problem's not drinking. My problem's sobriety. You separate me from alcohol without a program of action, and the clock is ticking. And the pain will increase to a point where I can't take it anymore, and I will not pick up a drink to crash a car, break a heart, or go to jail. I will pick up a drink to overcome an obsession of my mind that can't forget when it worked. I will pick up a drink because I can't take the madness and the pain of sobriety. and the madness and the pain of trying to live life on life's terms. And I will make the ultimate surrender one more time. And so I'm leaving my sister's house at 4:30 in the morning, where I'll walk about 30 minutes to get picked up by a guy who was kind enough to pick me up and take me to the job site and drop me off down the hill. And I'm sad, man, because I'm leaving AA. And it's dark and it's quiet out. You know, it's dark and quiet everywhere in the world at 4:30 in the morning. But it's loud in my head and it's sad. I'm so sad that I'm leaving AA. You know, the self-pity's just dripping off me. And I'm thinking about how disappointed my sponsor's going to be. God, he really tried. And one more thing that didn't work for a guy named Don. And I'm walking along, and then I saw him. And a couple of dogs got out of the neighbor's house. I guess beautiful, you know, Rottweilers, 90-pounders, magnificent beasts. And they were doing exactly what 90-pound Rottweilers do when they get out of the neighbor's house at 4:30 in the morning. They're chasing each other over hedges. And they're rolling on their back in the grass. And they're just so happy and playful and beautiful. And it just stopped me in my tracks. And I'm mesmerized by these dogs. And I got to be honest, it lifted my spirits. And then they saw me. And they looked at each other. And they looked at me. And they looked at, and they charged me. And I started screaming like a 6-year-old girl. Woo-hoo-hoo! And I started backing down the hill, and they were coming at my feet like these crazed. And of course, I'm the alcoholic matador trying to fend them off with my little pal lunchbox and my framing bags. And this goes on a quarter mile down the hill, and I was an incredible service to these dogs because they were having a ball with me. You know what I mean? Let's see how high he jumps this time. And I'm clearing hedges, and I get to the bottom of the hill, and they run back up the hill to go home, and I'm, and now I'm not leaving AA. Because you got to tell somebody that story, you know what I mean? I get to the meeting that night, I find my sponsor, and I tell him a 3-minute story the way a good newcomer tells it in 30 seconds. They were huge, they tried to kill me, and they had teeth like this, and I fought them off, and he listens patiently, and I get done, and he goes, "Well, I bet you're in the moment." My sponsor could put a spiritual spin on anything. He said, "You know, Don, I know I love you very much, and I know God loves you very much. And I hope he doesn't have to send any more Rottweilers after you to prove it." And he suggested that I start writing that inventory, and I concurred. And I started writing this inventory. And I'm going to talk about the resentment portion of the inventory. And there's a couple of things going into it that the book tells me I got to have on board. The first thing I got to have on board is I have to be convinced. I have to be convinced that self is what had defeated me. And if I don't think that I'm the problem on some level, if I haven't learned that in the first 3 steps, if I haven't seen that what I bring to the game is going to leave me dead, at least be open-minded to the possibility that I have something to do with my life being in the toilet, I'm not going to go to this with the openness and the honesty that's going to be required. And once I'm convinced of self with what had defeated me, I'm going to consider, how does it show up in my life? The book uses this language. What's its common manifestations? What does it look like? It's one thing to say, I'm selfish and I'm self-centered and I'm just a bad person. Great. What does it look like? How does it affect the people around you? How's it cutting you off? Can you give me an example? I don't know how to do that, man. But I'm going to consider how it shows up in my life. I'm going to look at 3 areas, resentments, fear, and sex. Charlie's going to talk about the fear and sex. I'm going to talk about the resentment. How does that show up in my life? And in the directions in the book, the first thing it's going to do is going to give me something to wrap my head around, something I identify with, something I can go, oh, we do it like that. And it's going to give me an example of a business inventory or a commercial inventory. It's going to explain to me a business inventory is a fact-finding, fact-facing proposition. And one of the things I'm going to do in that business inventory is I'm going to discover, and that word means new information. So I'm going to get some new information about the stock and trade. If the owner of the business is to be successful, I can't fool myself about values. And that's a huge word in the inventory. Hold on to that, values. And one of the efforts is to look at this inventory and find out what I have that's damaged or unsaleable. It has no value, and get rid of it promptly and without regret. And then it says, we did exactly the same thing with our lives. Not kind of likes, not imitating, exactly the same thing. I'm going to do a business inventory. I'm going to have a business-like attitude, and that's important when I do inventory, as much as possible to keep the emotion out of it, to be as business-like as possible. Why? Because emotion trips me up. Emotion makes me feel like I don't want to look anymore. Emotion makes me go, this is too hard. I can't do it. I can't look into the deep, dark recesses of my mind any longer. And then I'll drink and die. So I can't have that. What I do with the guys I sponsor, right? When they write inventory, I line them out on that. I talk about the business inventory. I give them a pad of paper and a pencil, and I walk into my kitchen. I have a roll-out pantry. I pull out the pantry. I say, start on the top shelf and start inventorying. Just list what's there. Say it out loud. They go, this is ridiculous. Just do it. All right. Two cans of corn, a bag of pinto beans. And I stop them right there. I go, that's enough. I go, notice you didn't say this. Oh, two cans of corn. Oh, my God. Oh, my God, there's a bag of pinto beans. Why is there a bag of... I don't even like pinto beans. I don't remember buying them. How did they get there? We're going to open the cupboard of our soul. We're going to look inside. We're going to start listing some stuff. Leave the emotion out of it and stop giving the false information in open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous where we scare the hell out of newcomers by going, oh, we'll see what kind of a member you are when you get to that four step. Scare the hell out of our new members. We make it seem like it's a bigger step than other steps. It's part of a process. Steps 4 through 9, how I'm going to turn my will and life over the care of God. That's how I do it, steps 4 through 9. Got to start somewhere. You know how we start? Let's inventory what we're working with. Let's find out what the raw material is. Let's find out what's in there that we won't even need to go forward with. We can start letting go of those things right as we're writing that four step. It's going to tell me why I'm going to have to do this. Resentment's the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. What's a spiritual disease? I don't know. Seven deadly sins, judgment of others, my pettiness, my envy. You know, you get a promotion at work. Hey, man, that's great. I'm so happy for you. Inside, I'm thinking, I hope you die in a fiery car crash. Yeah. I'm petty. I'm envious, right? I don't want to admit that stuff, but it's there. Trust me. All forms of spiritual disease. So what's the big deal about that? So I'm a petty person. I suffer from the seven deadly sins. I'm a resentment-based individual. I'm angry. I've been angry my whole life. What? So what? What's the big deal? Well, when I harbor such feelings, it cuts me off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and I drink. And for me to drink is to die. I have to make the connection. Anger and resentment, cut off from God, no higher power. Lack of power is my dilemma. Learn that in the second step. I forget that when I'm writing inventory. I won't be honest. I'll be cut off from God. Oh, you don't think resentment and anger cuts you off from God? Ooh, let me tell you, the next time you're really angry, and I'm not talking about irritated, and I'm not talking about perturbed, I'm talking about angry. The next time you're really angry, stop right there. Try to pray. Oh, good luck. Oh, you might be able to pray. It'll sound like this. Please, God, kill him. Kill him now. I can have no conscious contact when I'm harboring these feelings. But it's confusing. There's columns. There's writing. It's homework. I never liked homework. It's simple, man. You got to wrap your head. Why is it so important we wrap our head around this four-column process? We're going to use it for the rest of our life. I'm more interested that you get what's supposed to come out of this, the new information and the technique, than anything else. I mean, there's stuff that came out of my first inventory. It took me 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years to get the whole truth that was revealed in that inventory and apply it to my life. It's not about perfection. We don't want it perfect. We just want it. We're going to get better at this process, but it's new to me in the beginning. And so I'm going to write my first three columns. We make it sound like that's tough. Why? I've been writing these columns my entire life. And so have you. Who am I pissed off at? What did they do to piss me off? And what do I think it's affecting in my life because they pissed me off? I've been doing that my whole life. This should write itself. Be no big deal. We all know who's on the list. Mom, dad, every employer, every girl broke our heart. Every girl that didn't break our heart when, you know, every neighbor we ever had, anybody ever called the cops on us, the IRS, anything you can, everybody. Ask my sponsor who makes my resentment list. He goes, I don't know. You seem kind of angry. Who did you know? You know, that's fairly accurate. So I write these things down, right? Who I'm angry at. What they did to me. I love that. I love that all my life. I wish it would happen today in Alcoholics Anonymous. Wouldn't it be great if you called your sponsor up and he goes, how's it going, kid? And you go, got to tell you, I'm a little angry. And he got real serious and went, what did they do to you? You know, wouldn't that be great? My sponsor never says that. He says, what did you do? You know? But we get to have fun with this. Who are we angry at? What did they do? What do we think it affects? We get that all down on paper. We just list it down in a list. They gave us a little example. It's boring. We think to ourselves, that can't be it. That can't be. It's got to be more to it than that. I beg to differ. There's a little line before the outline. It's very important. I make sure my sponsees see this, if nothing else. We were usually as definite as this example. You know what that means? You don't have to write anymore. Stop killing your sponsors with the autobiographies. Don't show up with a notebook. Section A, Section B. Don't do that. That's not what we're talking about. You know, you're actually going to be there for the fifth step. I'll tell you how much I wrote. Here's my biggest resentment. Here's the mother of all my resentments, the juggernaut, the genesis resentment, the one that all the other resentments sprung from, the one that I could talk to you about for hours. This is how much I wrote on it. I'm resentful at my father. The cause, he left when I was 2 years old and he never looked back. What does it affect? My whole damn life. That's all I had to write. You know why? Because I was going to be there in the fifth step to fill in the blanks. And baby, trust me, I filled in the blanks. You know what I mean? And why do I make this point? Why do I think this is so important? If you get hung up on the writing, you cannot write without emotion being attached to it. And as you write, all those deep, dark feelings, those heavy emotional loads, at some point the pen becomes too heavy and your heart becomes too heavy. And you say, I just can't do this. It hurts too much. So we write enough down that we'll remember what we're going to bring to our sponsor and God in that fifth step. That's all we're going to do. So we're writing this list. And it's not a big deal. Top of page 66. There are things in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that I firmly believe. This is how I read the big book when I was new. And there's no wrong way to read the big book, but this is just how I read it. Very compartmentalized. If there was a line in the big book and it fell, for example, in the four-step portion of the big book, whatever information was contained in that line only applied to the four-step. I don't read the big book that way anymore. Every time there's a spiritual direction or a spiritual insight, I think that applies to me in my whole life. That it is not boundaried by the step I happen to be thinking about or working at that particular moment. And none bigger than this line here for me that says, to conclude that others were wrong was usually as far as most of us got. How often is that showing up in my life today? How often am I running by self-propulsion in my life today? And as I bang through the world, as I'm in collision with somebody or something, how easily do I just very calmly think to myself, oh, they're wrong, I'm right, that happens, and just keep moving. To conclude that others were wrong was usually as far as most of us got. And as far as I continue to get, on many an occasion. But here what we're talking about is those first three columns. That's as far as I ever really got. But now we're going to do something differently. I understand the futility and the fatality of my resentments. I understand that they cut me off from God. I understand these resentments must be mastered. But I can't wish them away any more than I can wish away alcohol. That's important spiritual information in the directions. Because what I've picked up is a principle of personal powerlessness in the first step, didn't I? But I had an idea about it. I wasn't telling my sponsor, but here's my idea. I'm powerless over alcohol and all that other crap, but I think that's enough. Thank you very much. And now what my book's telling me is I better take that idea of powerlessness and I better bring it into this inventory. And I better understand that if these resentments are to be mastered, the power needed to do that will not be supplied by me. And it takes humility. It takes an awareness of where my shortcomings are. That if I'm powerless and there's one that has all power, I'm going to have to bring him into this process. I know I can't live this angry life anymore. I know I can't be this guy. I know it's cutting me off from God. I know it's going to drive me back to the drink. But I don't know how to get rid of it. And the first thing is that I'm going to have to prepare myself to look at the fourth column in this inventory. And there's preparation, deep preparation that goes into before we start writing that fourth column. And the first thing I'm going to say is I'm going to look at this list and I'm going to be prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. What's the angle I've been looking at it from? Well, I've been looking at the angle of what they did, how it hurt me, how it affects me. I've been concluding that others were wrong, and it's as far as most of us have ever gotten. It's as far as I ever got. That's the angle. What's the new angle? I realize the people that wronged me are perhaps spiritually sick. That sounds familiar. At this point, I've been going to AA for 4 months, and I've come to the understanding that I suffer from a spiritual malady. I know I have a spiritual deficiency. I know that God is the answer, and I know I'm spiritually sick. First thing I'm going to do is I'm going to take that guy that I've been looking at from a position of looking down at, and I'm going to rise him up. Not bigger than me, not smaller than me, but equal to me. That perhaps, not saying he is, but perhaps he's spiritually sick, just like I am. Ooh, we just leveled the playing field. That is huge. Although I don't like their symptoms, what they did to me, and the way they disturb me, how it's affecting my life, they, like myself, were sick too. And now I'm going to go to God in prayer. And a prayer is really, for me, it's a method of asking God for something I don't have naturally in self-will. So I'm going to ask for God that I trust me, I don't have these things when I'm resentful at you. I'm going to ask God to grant me the same attitude I grant a sick friend, the same patience, pity, and tolerance. I don't have that when I'm resentful at you. And you know why? Because I think there's two different types of wrongs. Because when I do somebody wrong, like my good friend Charlie, you know, I love Charlie, but there's a possibility that somewhere in our relationship, I may step on Charlie's toes. I may do Charlie wrong. I won't mean to. Maybe I'm just being inconsiderate. I wasn't aware. But when I become aware of it, there are some things that I will require from Charlie. I will hope to receive from Charlie. I'd like some understanding. I'd like some empathy. I really could use a little forgiveness, Charlie. Now, because Charlie is human and imperfect, he may, in our course of our relationship, step on my toes and do me wrong because he works a program. He may become aware of it, and there's some things that he's going to want from me, but I'm going to want a different list from Charlie when he does me wrong. You know, Charlie, I'd like some revenge. Maybe a little retribution. And if you are going to apologize, could you do it in a, I don't know, groveling manner? So I understand that you understand just how wrong you really are. Because I think there's two different types of wrongs, and that may seem absurd, but I'll tell you, don't we live our life that way? I have perfect 20/20 vision on how you've hurt me. But I come to Alcoholics Anonymous singing an old newcomer song, "The Only Person I Hurt Was Myself." Heck, I don't even think I have resentments till I sober up and start just living in my head, and then I go, "Ooh, got some resentments." But if you ask me a question, "Well, who did you hurt, kid?" I got no answer. Why? I've never thought about it at all. I've been so obsessed with the narrative of the story of my life and what they've done to me and how it hurt me. And if you had been treated the way I was treated, if you grew up in that house and you had that father and you had that mother and blah, 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 you turned out the way I did. And why don't you walk a mile in my shoes before you judge me? And on. It's exhausting. I've been telling that story for 30 years by the time I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's like plugging in a tape. I don't even have to think about it. It's like, well, what's your story? Well, you know, my father left when I was 2. It's a Johnny Cash song is what it is. You know, it's... Ask God to grant me this new attitude. And then I say another prayer. I say, God, save me. Save me from being angry. Could as well have said, God, save me from dying. Because the fatality involved with these resentments is going to kill me. And if I don't get rid of them, I'm going back to the drink. And for me to drink is to die. God saved me from being angry. Now, what's interesting in all that, you'll notice, is there's no directions about me praying for others. I'm looking, it's not there. Yet I go to open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and occasionally this is what I hear. Well, I had a tough day at work because of my boss. You know my boss, the spiritually sick one. Ah, boy, he could use a program, but he's just sick. He can't help it. You know, he's just nobody likes him. But you know what? I'm doing what AA's taught me, and I'm praying for him. I'm praying for his happiness. I'm praying that he gets everything that I want for myself. I'm praying for him because he just can't help it. And I'll go to another meeting. Some woman will share, yeah, my sister-in-law, you know, she's spiritually sick. Good, poor girl just can't help it. You know, she is just a slut. I don't know what to tell you. And, oh, my goodness, you know, just embarrassing the way she acts in the family, you know. But she can't help it. She's spiritually sick. But I'm doing what AA teaches me. I am praying for her, God bless her soul. And I am hoping that she's happy and gets everything I have. Let me ask you something. When you're praying for another person, do you think you're praying from a position of superiority or inferiority? It's always from a position of superiority. And what happens when I process my resentments through prayer only? I get resentful, you piss me off, you're spiritually sick, I'm going to pray for you, we're all done. To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. I'm right back doing that again, and I'm dressing it up in spiritual language. And here's the biggest thing. I will screw myself out of the biggest gift an alcoholic can ever receive. It's a little something around here we call the truth. I'll never get to the truth of what happened, because why would I? I already know you're wrong. I don't need to look at myself. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to set aside the wrongdoings of others, and I'm resolutely going to look for my own mistakes. Not my part, not my small percentage that I was wrong, mostly you, but we'll see where maybe I got the... I'm going to set it aside. Not forever. It doesn't mean it didn't happen. People misunderstand that. Trust me, my dad left when I was 2 years old, never said a dime of support, never acknowledged our existence, right? That'll leave a mark on you. That's not a good thing. It's not that it didn't happen. My sponsor didn't tell me it was a good thing. He didn't tell me to have a new attitude about it. He said, just set it aside for a minute. Can you do that? Can you just set it aside? Turn your back on it, and let's look for our own mistakes. Where was I selfish, inconsiderate, dishonest, or afraid? Where was I in judgment of others? Where was I petty and inconsiderate? I'm going to get this all down, and I'm going to look at it. I'm probably going to need a lot of help from my sponsor the first fourth column that I do, right? Because I don't have the clarity to know that. And luckily, your sponsor will be there in the fifth step. So the stuff you can't, the parts that you're missing in that fourth column, he can help you fill those out. She can help you fill those out when you get to the fourth column. And I do that, and here's the magic. This pivot, this 180-degree turn that we make in the fourth step, where all my life I've been looking at you and what you do wrong with this 2020 vision of how you've affected my life and you've hurt my life and everything's wrong with me and I wear the coat of the victim. I walk in absolutely knowing that that's the truth. And I walk out of the inventory process one step from now with a completely different attitude about my entire life. And if that pivot, if that 180-degree turn catches and the gears mesh and they lock in place, you'll never be the same again. You'll never be able to look at your resentments the same way again. You know, it's a very interesting thing what my resentments are like today, because I get resentments. I get them all the time. If it's Monday through Friday and it's a work day, I'll tell you, I wake up and I'm pretty spiritual. My first word in my mind is God. Unfortunately, the second word is, damn it. And I wake up a little resentful that I have to work for a living. You know what I mean? It's like, I understand resentment. But resentment for me is an indicator. Before, it was just a state of being. It's just how I live my life. It's like, you seem like an angry guy. What's your point, Scooter? You know? Everybody's angry. No, not really. Get away from me. You know? But it's an indicator today. What's it an indicator of? Something's wrong with my spiritual condition. You know, I live in Bellingham, Washington. You know, we live about 8 miles out of town. We're out by the lake, and it's 150-foot trees, and it's the woods, man. And most of the roads where I live are two-lane roads. I mean, there's no guardrails. There's nothing. You know, just drop off down embankments, and you got to pay attention when you drive. And it's just two lanes with a yellow striped line. And what they do with the asphalt is they cut deep grooves into the asphalt right in the center of the two lanes. And you can't even see them, right? Because they paint right over them with the yellow line. But sometimes you're driving along and you don't pay attention, right? And you'll move your tire over, and when you hit that, you won't see it, but you'll feel it. It'll send a huge vibration through your whole car. And what it's telling you right at that moment is, hey, man, you're headed for trouble, and you need to get back in your lane to avoid disaster. And I got to tell you, resentment's that indicator today. When I feel that anger, I feel that resentment, it's that indicator. It's that vibration that I can feel, because like my favorite thing I've ever heard about resentment is like peeing in your pants. Everybody can see it, but you're the only one that can feel it. And I feel that negative vibration in my life. It's an indication to me that there's something wrong with my spiritual condition. There's something wrong with it. I'm out of my lane. I need to correct. I'm headed for disaster. And that's what we're talking about with this 180-degree turn, where I'm ready to look at this list from an entirely different angle. I have to get back in my lane. I have to stop worrying about yours. And I'll give you an example of what that fourth column can look for. I had a deep-seated resentment against my mother. My mother's alcoholic, saw a lot of things growing up and was subjected to a lot of things. And if you've grown up in an alcoholic home, I don't have to fill in the blanks for you. And I blame my mother for my father leaving, and I blame my mother for the poverty that we grew up in, and I blame my mother for being afraid, and I blame my mother for her drinking, and I blame my mother for having a different uncle every couple of months, and I blame my mother for all those stories I was quick to tell about how horrible this woman was. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was filled with spite and rage and venom for this woman. It had so affected my life. And it's funny, the things I conveniently forgot on my way to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's funny the things I conveniently forgot in order to wear the coat of the victim. It's funny the things I conveniently forgot to keep the story and the narrative going, where I could tell people about my tough childhood. And hopefully you would say this to me, it's not your fault. Because that's really what I want to believe. You see, my resentments are really my explanation for a poorly lived life. They comfort me in the terror of the night when I can't pour enough whiskey down to forget how bad my life's begun, and I can think about those resentments and go, yeah, that's why I ended up this way. But in a sober state, it's hard to buy the lie, and it's even harder when you get to that fourth column in the resentment portion. And I remembered some things about my mother I conveniently forgot. Here's a woman that raised three kids on her own, never took a dime of welfare. She got us up in the morning, she got us fed, she got us off to school and took two buses to work, and then took two buses home to pick us up from school, to take us home, to help us with our homework, to make sure we got fed and we had clothes on our back. She sacrificed her entire life for her three children. She grew up in a gang-ridden, poverty impoverished neighborhood in Hollywood, California. And she taught love, and she taught respect, and she taught curfew, and she taught she wasn't playing around, and she kept us safe. She didn't know much, but she knew her kids were going to survive, and they weren't going to be subject to the street. And yet this woman, what I just told you about, that sacrificed her whole life for her children, I demonized before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And now I look at it as no more, and I've never seen a greater example of love in my life. And that's what resentment does for me. It can take the greatest story of my life and the greatest facts of my life, and it can twist them so I can keep the narrative going, so I can justify my reason to take one more drink. I go into inventory writing a resentment list, completely convinced that they're the problem, and I walk out of it knowing that I'm the problem. And I'll tell you, what does that look like today? What does a four-column resentment look like today? How do you process that today? Well, I'll just give you a quick little story about resentment, what it looks like in my life today, and how the four columns are alive. You know, I don't have to sequester myself in a room. I don't have to call my sponsor. I can do the four-column inventory on the fly. And I learned that in the four-step. So about 5 years ago, I come home from work. I'm there a little early. Eileen's not there yet. And I go inside, and there's this commotion in my backyard. And I look in my backyard, and there's the neighbor's dog from four houses up. He's chasing one of my cats to the backyard. My cat's running for his life. And I'm immediately pissed off. because I've been kind, I've been nice, I've talked to the family, can you please not let your dog loose? We're in a no-fence neighborhood, we're not allowed to have fences. If you have your dog out, he's got to be on a leash, you got to have him under control, and here's this dog raising hell in my, you know. And so I did something spiritual, like said, hey, dog, you know, and ran down to the backyard, and I'm chased the dog out of my backyard, and I chased the dog all the way up the street, and he periodically stops and turns around at me and growls at me and goes, arr, and I growl at him, arr, and so we're growling at each other, and I get him up, and right as he gets up to his house, the door opens up, and there's the 14-year-old son, you know, the neighbor of the family that lives there, looking like 14-year-old kids do, what, and I take a deep breath, man, and I try to work my program, and I think I say calmly, I've talked to you about this before. I'm going to need your help here, buddy. Your dog's out again. He's chasing my cats around. You know, he's not supposed to be out. We both know this. Your family said it won't happen again. He goes, oh, he'd never hurt a cat. He's the kindest dog. I believe you. I believe you. But here's the problem. I don't know that, and the cat certainly doesn't know that. And so now I'm trying to logically talk to a 14-year-old who was busy playing video games and smoking dope and let the dog out because he didn't want to walk him. And I realize I'm doing that, and I'm talking to the wrong person. I go, you know what? Never mind. But this isn't going anywhere. Do me a favor. When your father gets home, have him call me. And this is what the 14-year-old, 5'5", 130-pound kid says. What makes you think my father wants to listen to any of your crap? So I have a vision for you. I'm in a courtroom. There's a 14-year-old kid with two broken arms and legs in a wheelchair. And I'm trying to explain to the judge that he hurt my feelings. I was so angry I couldn't talk. I just vibrated around and walked down the hill. Now I'm in my house, and I'm standing in my kitchen looking out the window because I have a clear view of the house. After about 15 minutes, my legs got tired. So I got a stool from the breakfast bar, and I sat in front of the sink so I could be comfortable as I stalked the family. It's 3:30 in the afternoon. The father usually doesn't get home till about 6:30. That's okay, I can wait. And as I'm bathing in the resentment and the negative fantasies that are awful, what's going to happen when I confront this guy? It's awful, hideous stuff, B-movie stuff. My sponsor's voice from somewhere in the recesses of my mind says, I think you've got a resentment. Do a four column on that. I'm resentful at 14-year-old kid. Right there, you start feeling weenie, don't you? Yeah. I'm 6'5", 280 pounds. He hurt my feelings. What did he do? He disrespected me. He wasn't afraid of me. He won't do what I want him to do. He's acting like a 14-year-old. It's pissing me off. What does it affect? Well, it affects my confidence. Affects my security, affects my self-esteem, probably going to affect my sex relations, because who wants to sleep with a guy who gets mad at 14-year-olds? Jesus. Resolutely putting out of my mind the wrongdoings of others. I got to look for where I was wrong, where I got the ball rolling, what my mistakes are. Longfellow said, if we could read the secret history of our enemies, we would find in each man's life pain and suffering enough to disarm all hostility. I don't know anything about that house. I don't know anything about that kid. I don't know what he's living with or what he's living without. I remembered being 14 years old and the madness going on in my house. I remember being dragged into the principal's office over and over again because I couldn't stop putting my hands on other kids, starting fights. I remember the brushes with the law. I remember the inability to talk to people about what was happening in my home. And I thought, for all I know, this kid's the same as me. I went up, knocked on the door, apologized to the kid, made my amends. He said, whatever, dude, you know. Great spiritual moment. 2 weeks later, I'm in the front yard. It's summertime. And the car comes down from the street, and it's the family. And the father's in the front seat, and the kid's in the passenger seat, and the windows are down because it's summer. And I could hear him coming from three houses away because the father's yelling at the kid so loud. And as they go by, he's screaming on the top of his lungs at the kid, and he's effing him, and he's this, and he's that. And the kid's got his head down, and he's looking at his shoes. If I could read the secret history of my enemies, I'd find in each man's life pain and suffering enough to disarm hostility. But I'll never know that secret history, and I have to assume that I'm the same as the other guy. And if nothing else, what that resentment portion of the four-step inventory did for me many years ago and continues to do for me today is to remember, I'm not better than you, and I'm not worse than you. I'm just like you. Thanks for listening.